happy to be here, to get to have the chance to be with you all, and to try to get to know you, and to try to get you to know me and my family. I appreciate the opportunity. I was talking to Kevin this morning, getting a phone call from him. It's been a few weeks now, maybe a couple months ago. That was just really encouraging. I'm in the process of looking for work, and for someone to say yes, we would like you to work. That was a good thing to hear. Just personally, that kind of a pat on the back. So, hearing that from you all is kind of the way that I heard that, and so that means a lot to me, and I appreciate that. You have helped me with my support for the work that I've been doing in Albany and in Rhode Island the past few years, and that means a lot to me as well. And so I always enjoy getting the chance to come and say hello and to show more than two quarters of my face. But I appreciate this chance and this opportunity. Some of you I feel like I know really well, and some of you I know that pretend well, right? That we all pretend like we know each other because we've bumped into each other a number of times. I've been here a bunch of times, and you know, hopefully we can get past some of the pretend knowing wells. That's not an insult. I'm just trying to admit the fact that I can forget your name and kind of remember your face, and we can do that for a few years because we only see each other once every couple years, and that's life. That's not terrible. But hopefully we can get to know each other well. If you have any other questions for me or anything, I'd really welcome that. If you want to try to get together, you know, I'll be outside after this afternoon to talk, or if you want to go somewhere and visit with me and my family, trying to find some sort of, I mean, with the COVID issues, that makes everything complicated, and I want to try to make things nice and easy and comfortable, even if it's uncomfortably 90 degrees out. I'm happy to try to work with you on that. And though we're all sick and tired of Zoom, if it wasn't for COVID, the fact that you could basically look someone in the face and have a conversation over your computer for 20, 30 minutes whenever you want to, I mean, you do realize Zoom is pretty awesome. So if you have any random questions, or if you want to chat or do something like that with me at any, you know, at any time after I've left, I'd welcome that as well. I have my wife and my four kids. The fourth is a year old today. So that's kind of exciting. And so you can get to know them. I can tell you their names if you are good at, I'm not good at remembering things, so I won't. It's Jack and Thomas and Alice and Mary. And that's their names. I would forget them if they weren't my own kids' names, so I'm not expecting these sorts of high demands out of you, but I think that they're pretty decent kids, and I hope that you can get to know them as well. One thing I wanted to mention, I know that some of my sermons from Mohawk Valley were sent out. The website at Lincoln didn't have a system to have a bunch of sermons stored in there. And so a lot of the sermons were saved on Zoom, and I had those on my YouTube site, but that was essentially no one really goes to Zoom to watch a guy in a mask talk for 45 minutes. So that was cluttering up the YouTube page that I was trying to make easy for people to sift through. So I can make those available as well. I had forgotten to mention that they're just hidden. So they're out there if you want to hear some sermons like that. My YouTube channel has the kids class that I've been doing. Just took a break for a few months over the summer, but we're starting that up again in the next week. And the point of the kids class was, well, essentially a lot of Bible classes were getting canceled or put on hold, so let's just have something that can run. And if I put it on YouTube, kids who aren't available at that time can join in. But I also wanted to let the kids not have boring Bible class. So we did Revelation and Daniel. We did some parables and we did Acts. And now we're going through the Psalms. And there is a difference, but there's not much of a difference in the way I teach the book of Revelation to children and to adults. The vocabulary, you will get a higher vocabulary, and I don't have to explain some of the things to you. But I have found that the exciting, crazy questions about the book of Revelation have nothing to do with the book of Revelation. And so, you know, there's been some adults that went through the class with us, and we're excited to just read through the text. And the kids are drawing pictures. That's the way they're taking notes. That's the whole point of the drawing pictures, is that you're taking notes on the text. And so those are some of the things that I have out there. And I do have a podcast called Reading the Psalms. Some of you may know about that. And I've been transferring it to YouTube. The audio, just in case people aren't, there's some people who aren't on the podcast thing. So a lot of those are on the YouTube channel as well. And they're really short little things. So that's some of the material I have that you can go check out. And if you want more of this, it's out there. For whatever that's worth, it is available and it's out there. I'm going to do a set of lessons this weekend from John. One of the amazing things about doing a gospel meeting, which is not what this is, but in a lot of ways, there's a lot of similarities. So I'm going to talk about it like it's a gospel meeting. When you do a gospel meeting, you are a superhero. It's the best material. It's been polished. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and then he goes home and you're stuck with just your preacher. So that's the way gospel meetings work. And so what I tried to do, I didn't like scrape bottom of the barrel sermons, but I did these lessons March and into April in Rhode Island. So it's a series in that I did sermons from the Gospel of John. But it doesn't have a beginning, and it doesn't have an ending. This is the first one, and it starts in John 4, and John doesn't begin in John 4. So I just started reading through and finding I want to preach about this, and I want to preach about this, and I want to preach about this. And there's six of them that I did, and I have time for four, and I'm still trying to figure out which of the four I want to do. So one of my thoughts is I don't think they're bad lessons, but these are more just these are four sermons that I did this spring. They kind of address, they don't address a single theme. If I think it talks about something that might be relevant to this or that, I'm trying to do sermons in that way. So this might be more normal than like if I came and did a gospel meeting. Set my stopwatch. So I'm just hoping that it's like, this is just a pile of sermons. This is the way I try to share and try to teach. And hopefully that can be helpful. All right, so in John chapter 4, one of the problems with this story is that we all know it, and everyone could preach a sermon on John chapter 4, and that was one of the things, okay, what is in the Gospel of John? Not that I've never seen before, because that's pretty rare, but what is still in these stories that we need to pull out? And I didn't want the John 4 talk, where Jesus had talked to the Samaritan woman, I didn't want it to be an evangelism sermon. Sometimes it's we can see he's talking to someone new, and we can get some ideas there. And so I wasn't writing an evangelism sermon at all, but ended up being, I noticed that Jesus does a lot of connecting or not connecting with people. So it's not evangelism, but it's connections with people. He connects with or sees failure in connection with his disciples at the end of the story. And that's not evangelism. That's just the people that he's interacting with. And so connections with people, I think, is a big deal in this story. Jesus connects with people, not movements, not groups, not organizations. Sometimes he's talking to the Pharisees, or as John calls it, the Jews. But that's not an organization. They made themselves like one when they came to attack Jesus at times. But Jesus didn't address organizations. He didn't, we can say maybe he was a grassroots kind of guy because he's just talking to the people standing on the grass, but he didn't create a grassroots movement. He just talked to people, and then people, and then people, and then people. And that's what we see is happens in here. I think that that's really powerful. And so he finds people in need, and he speaks to those needs. And I think that that's something that we should work on. And James 3:18, a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace, just kept coming up in my mind as I was reading through this story. So that's going to show up a couple times. The way Jesus was cultivating and nourishing peace and connection with, in particular, the one lady, and then at the end of the story, we see with everyone in town, or as far as we can tell, everyone in town. So let's read verses 1 through 6. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus is making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour, which is noon. But I only know that because my footnote tells me it's noon. So Jesus actively avoids the disconnecting people. And I hadn't thought of that. That's something new to me, right? When the Pharisees hear that Jesus is doing more and more and more, Jesus leaves. And we can tell from the other Gospels and even from the rest of the Gospel of John, it's not because he's scared, right? He's not, they're finding out and I need to go hide. If anything, it's, I need to delay what they're going to try to get to happen, right? So maybe he's afraid of a separate timeline. He's absolutely in control, right? And so they are people who want to stir up, and Jesus is not somebody who wants to stir up. He kind of stirs up this lady, but he's not stirring up arguments. He's not stirring up those sorts of things. And so he doesn't stick around. They want to stir up trouble. He's not going to engage in that. I think that that's kind of interesting. Now, he goes to Samaria, and you can argue that he does stir up the town. Well, he does, but it's in a different direction, right? The Pharisees, let's just sum it up. They want to close off. And what does Jesus do when he stirs up an entire town? He opens it up. He opens it up to their opportunities in God. So you can see those different directions. And so in Hebrews 10, 25 and 26, let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some. I think sometimes we think that's the thou shalt go to church verse. It's the thou shalt figure out how to stir up one another to love and good works verse. And going to church is a big part of that, is I think what those two verses are saying. The Pharisees are standing over here. They are trying to close off, and Jesus is trying to stir up towards love and good works, and they're going to go against that. So he moves on, and in verse 7, a woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and all his livestock." So Jesus begins to connect. The Pharisees were people who liked to disconnect. That's what I'm saying. I don't know if that really works, but for the purpose of this lesson, they want to disconnect things and they want to cut people off. And this lady could not be a more disconnected person, right? She's wrong on every level. She's not a Jew, and you almost get the impression that the Samaritans were almost worse than the Gentiles because they were almost Jewish. You get that sort of ugly, so she's worse than the worst, and to make matters even worse than the worst, she's a lady, and it's her fault. You know, like that's kind of the image maybe that the society is putting onto her, and so she is an unconnected or a disconnected person, and he begins that connection, and that's just really cool. And he begins a connection with a disconnected outsider when he was weary. So that's what it said in verse 6. He is worn out. He's had it up to here. I'm talking about it. I'm a dad with four kids. I've had it up to here, and I've got the kids, and we've been in the car, and here's this lady, and now I need to do the right thing and connect with her. I'm trying to imagine what does weary mean to me? What would that be for him? And so he opens up and he begins this connection to her by talking about water. Give me some drink, give me some water. And they keep that talk about water. It's not really that amazing. I don't know if we want to figure out how to get someone who doesn't know you to talk to you. You can maybe get some clues there, but he's sitting at a well and she's getting water. He doesn't bring up football. He talks about the thing that they are both dealing with at that moment. And her reaction shows we are not supposed to connect. Like, what are you talking about? What are you doing here? This is weird. Although, if she honestly felt that way in like an offended way, my impression is that she would have just kind of stepped back and turned around. She talks to him. What are you talking to me for? We're not supposed to be talking together. And I'm kind of giving it that bouncy tone of voice. But she is engaging in this. What are you doing? We're not supposed to talk. And I think that that's just kind of interesting here, that Jesus must have looked like a nice guy, right? Give me something to drink. And she says, what are you doing? We're not supposed to be talking together. We're not supposed to have a connection. And she is confirming the connection right back to Jesus. And I think that that's just neat. And he immediately goes, if you knew who it was, which there's a lot of times I notice in the Bible that if Jesus wasn't the Son of God, he would be one vain dude saying, if you knew who was talking to you. It's like, no one should talk that way. And I'm not going to talk that way. If you knew that I am a preacher, you know, no one should ever talk that way. But he goes there with some people. And it's just interesting to me. If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, then you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. That sentence is loaded with big ideas. The gift of God. All right, well, what's the gift of God? How many things are we going to start listing? You know, kids' classes are great. What's the gift of God? And they'll give you 400 things, and they're all right. The great promise of old is the way I'm answering that to myself. If you knew the gift of God, and you say the promise, and that kind of covers everything, right? I don't know what Jesus is exactly talking about. If you knew the gift of God and who it is that's talking to you, Jesus is putting the emphasis on himself, which so often he does not do. Are you, you have said so. He has some of these deflecting statements. Or he's leaving the Pharisees because they want to cause a rumpus. But when he is talking with this lady, he's letting her know that he, not me, he is important. And I think that's really interesting. He wanted people to notice that he was not just some guy. I use the phrase, you know, he'd be a vain dude. He's not just some guy. He's not just some dude. He's not just some man. He is someone important. And he starts talking about living water, which is just such a fun phrase, right? What is he talking about there? Life, that it feeds correctly and it feeds well. You know, the idea of living water is such a poetic image, right? What does it mean? Life and movement and crystal clear and waves, that's what I think of. You know, the babbling brook, the bumping on top of rocks. A river might be clean, but if I can't jump over it, I have this image of it being, it's probably filthy, right? It's big, and so it's lumbering. But if it's this little noisy little thing, it's got to be something clean, and I can drink out of that little bit. I don't know if that's true, but we have these images. And so Jesus is referring to this great idea of living water. It could go back to like that it's a spring, that it's moving water, it's alive, rather than just a pond with the duckweed or the stagnant pool. There's the great line in Jeremiah 2:13, how the people are forsaking the living waters and they're going after cisterns that are broken and they don't hold water. You know, go for the water that actually works, not for the dirty bottles over here, that sort of image. So I don't know if Jesus is making that connection, but he's talking about those sorts of things. And so the gift of God and who it is and this living water, Jesus gives us a lot of phrases every once in a while that we can stop and just kind of think about for a while. What does that mean? And she responds back to this by saying, you can't do that. You can't give me living water because, you know, your arm doesn't reach long enough. And are you saying you're bigger, if you knew who it is that is speaking to you, are you saying that you're bigger than the guy who gave us this well? And she's basing, you know, going back to this heritage. So she calls him on that. I think that that's pretty neat. And he says yes, right? And so she is saying, you can't get this water. There's not a real way that you can do it. In the previous chapter, Nicodemus said the same kind of thing. What do you mean? Am I supposed to go back inside my mom? And so I think the sarcastic reaction, I don't think he was being serious when he said that, right? I think Nicodemus was being sarcastic. And so I transfer that sarcasm to this lady. What are you talking about? I'm the one with the bucket. I'm the one who can get, you can't get me any of this water. And this hung up on the circumstance that Jesus was talking about. Sometimes we like to laugh and make fun of them because they were so focused on the physical, and there's absolutely no way that we would ever be focused on physical things and get distracted from the spiritual, right? And you know, we just do that. We do that ourselves. He wanted her, I think, to work, like, to feed the curiosity. What do you mean? How are you going to get that, right? And the imagination of, what is this guy talking about? He's saying he's something big. Is he just boasting, or is he something real? Why is he talking to me? It seems like Jesus is feeding a lot of those sorts of ideas in her, and they need to be fed in us. You might come up with an answer of what is the gift of God, but you better be careful to admit that there's no way that that can be the answer, right? Because the moment you say, this is the gift of God, you've just cut out a whole bunch of other gifts of God, right? And so it's that idea of allowing the, we need to keep wondering and thinking about some of these ideas. We can know big ideas, and we can know the importance of, you know, Jesus is the gift of God. We can have some, nail some things down. But I don't want anybody to be dogmatic and say, I figured out what this phrase means, because I could probably come up with some other answers to that too. So I think Jesus is feeding that in her, which the Pharisees weren't liking, I would guess. All right, we'll continue in verse 13. Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, and then here we go with tone. What tone are you going to go with? Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water, is one option. The one I like is, sir, well, give me this water so that I never have to come back here and get water again. You know, I think she's being sarcastic and she's a tired mom or something like that, right? I have the picture of the women who are actually carrying these giant containers of water. And I don't think that they would take this line seriously from Jesus. Like, I've been hauling this my whole life. Guys don't do this. What do you think you're talking about? Not that she was mean, but that's the tone that at least Dan Bunting would have if he was the lady carrying water back and forth. I just think that this is such a neat moment here. Well, he keeps the conversation going in the right direction. She brought up, are you bigger than Jacob? And all of a sudden, the Jew-Samaritan fight would begin. And Jesus doesn't go there. Are you bigger than Jacob? And he keeps it to the right stuff, doesn't he? That argument would have been like a Pharisee closing off the walls and he proving that you're just a dumb Samaritan lady. And you don't know what you're talking about. And all that would have proved to her was that he was just a dumb Jewish guy who doesn't know what he's talking about, right? He kept it going in the right direction. He didn't let the degenerating arguments, which is the kind of thing we see in 1 Timothy, they think they know what they're talking about, but they just spiral into problems. He didn't let the connection go there. He kept it to be going back and forth. And so he talks about why his water would be better, right? This water that Jesus can give completes and brings to perfection. When you drink it, you will no longer thirst. Every time I try to solve thirst, I have found that I didn't. And that's the world in a nutshell. Now, I might not need a drink for another hour or three, but I have never had a drink that solved thirst. And that's what Jesus is talking about. And so he says, if I give you this water, it will well up inside you and you will never be thirsty again. Now, I think she's clearly moving past just this physical thinking, because if she was stuck on physical thinking, this would sound like I'm going to drown from the inside. This sounds terrible, right? So she's getting the connection that he's talking about here. Whoever drinks this will never be thirsty again. You'll have the eternal life welling up inside you. And so Jesus is giving her this, you will never thirst forever when you drink what I offer. And he wants her to think about that. You know, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. In Isaiah 12, with joy you will draw water from the springs of salvation. Well, how much salvation do you want? It's a spring. You can get as many buckets as you want of this. And so it's this offering of life and this pushing forward of good things. I think this is probably the... And so the woman, she's tired, and I think she's laughing about it. Not ugly, just the way that everybody laughs at someone saying something, well, you'll never be thirsty again. It's like, yeah, right. You know, I've seen the infomercials. That can't be true. So, but Jesus is connecting with her absolute reality. He knows she is a tired woman. It doesn't take much observation to figure out. Number one, she's a woman. And Number two, if she's a woman, she's probably tired because she's doing carrying water all over the place. And so he is connecting to that. In Matthew 11, 28, come to me, all you who are labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. You will find rest for your souls. There's plenty of times that Jesus talks about obedience, and he's going to talk about it, insinuate it in just a moment. But he's talking about grace and rest and opportunity. And I think that that's really interesting. And so we have here Jesus. Sometimes I've heard people say, Jesus, this great salesman. Or we need to have outreach and evangelism like sales. I get why people make that connection. A good salesman has the nerve to talk to somebody or keep a conversation going. I get those connections. But that's not what Jesus is doing here. He's not trying to fool someone into something. He's letting her walk, meeting him in these conversations. He's not just offering mega water. He's offering a way for her to not thirst, even if she still has to carry water every day. And so in 16, Jesus says, go call your husband and come here. And the woman said to him, answered him, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, you were right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive you are a prophet. I don't know what the tone is there. I don't know. A lot of people say, oh, let's change the subject. I usually go with the sarcastic kind of moments like that. And I don't lean towards that one in this one. I don't know what her attitude is. I think she's impressed. She might be intimidated. I don't know what... every time I read that, I don't know what to make my voice sound like. Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is of the Jews, or from the Jews. But the hour is coming and it is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. How many times does Jesus say that? Right? And who gets this statement? I don't think she's a loser, but in the context, this loser from Loserville, right? That's the context. I don't feel that way about her. I think she's pretty awesome. The way she reacts so well and goes and gets everybody in town. That's who he tells this to. I think that's one of the minor proofs of the Gospels. Jesus didn't come down and tell the king, I am the new guy, and the king bows down and gives him all the crowns, like we see in Revelation. Jesus comes and he's born in a barn and he's talking to this lady and tells her who he is. I think that that's really interesting to me. So Jesus proves himself in verses 16 through 18. He tells her things he should not be able to know. And probably from her perspective that he should not know, right? No, I don't want people talking about this sort of stuff. He knows and understands who she is. His understanding bears weight. He doesn't just say, I think you have a two-car garage and there's a leak in the corner of your roof. And wow, how did you know these things about me? He says things that absolutely matter. And let's be honest, they're not talking points, right? We don't talk. Well, maybe it was back then. I don't think so, though. We don't talk about that today to strangers. He's not really condemning her. And I think that that's interesting. It's very compelling. He said, you're right. He doesn't condemn her, but he doesn't exclude judgment from it, right? Listen to how he responds to her. You're right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you have is not your husband. What you have said is true. And she knows that he would say that the implication here is this is a not right situation. And she doesn't have any doubts of whether Jesus is the kind of guy, is he the kind of man, I should say, I don't want to talk about Jesus this way. Is this some guy who wants to go on a date with me, or some? Is he think that that sort of lifestyle is okay? No, the way Jesus is talking about this, she can tell that Jesus thinks that this is a not right way to live. And he probably didn't have to do angry, frowny eyebrows and a wagging finger to communicate this. And that's something I'm trying to figure out in my own life. How do I say that is wrong, and it be honest and sincere, and people can get that without the, you know, the hammer blow that sometimes comes with that? We're living in a world that's wrong, and people kind of know that, and they know we think so too. And so I've been surprised. There's a lot of times when I'm speaking with friends who either have family members who have homosexual relationships, or they are gay themselves, and I'm just have, and they know I'm a preacher, and I have been able to say, well, I think that that's wrong. And then we can, if that's what we're talking about, it's not like in the middle of something. I think that homosexuality is wrong. If we're talking about their friend or that relationship, that's something I believe is wrong because the Bible says so. And I try to say that without the frowny eyebrows and those sorts of things, because it's, the reality is it's wrong because the Bible says so. And that's kind of the way Jesus is saying it. Now, he has the weight. He is the Bible. But he's saying, you're right, that's wrong. And I'm just impressed at the way that the connection continues there. Now, she might be trying to avoid the topic of her husbands, or not husbands, by bringing up the prophet question. Oh, well, let's talk about this instead. That could be it. It could be this is the fruit of the connection. You know, the harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. He said something hard in a soft way, I guess. I don't know. And she is willing to ask a spiritually driven question with him. That's compelling. And that's what we need to be better at, having that kind of a conversation with someone. It would be a common question, I would imagine, back then. You say it's there and we say it's here. We have a lot of similar conversations today. Well, you say you got to go into a church building, but I just go out and I go on the mountain, or I do my thing with nature, or if it's another religion. You say it's this church and I say it's this temple, or you say it's this denomination and I say it's this. So this is a common conversation even today. And so she's asking that kind of thing, which is her investing in that connection right back. And I think that that's where Jesus has won her over, that we can see that she is invested back with him. And Jesus' answer again is such a good answer. In verse 21, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father." Now in verse 22, he answers her question, though. He doesn't do it first. In verse 22, he says, "You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews." And so he lets her know what the truth is. You don't know what you're talking about, and we do know what we're talking about because God gave this to the Jews. That could have been very offensive, but because this is verse 22 and not verse 9, it's not offensive. And he's saying, kind of the way that we do when we point to the Bible, God has said what is right, and that is what is right. I think that that's what he's doing here. But verses 21 and 23 and 24 is again opening it up. Jesus is the one who opens it up. We can't open up new options, but Jesus is showing this opening. "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship." Then he gives her the truth. There is a right place to do it. But, verse 23, "The hour is coming and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father, not in church, not in temple, not in this mountain or on this mountain, but in spirit and truth. The Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." And he just opened it up to more than just the temple. Now, I think that while Jesus was around, it had to be the temple, but he's letting everybody know it's more than just the walls of the temple, which is what the Old Testament has always said, right? It's more than just these physical things. Jesus is saying that change is coming, God already addressed this. He told the Jews what to do. Go ask a Jew. She is asking a Jew, but go ask a Jewish person and you will get the answer. You don't get to just make up your own idea. But Jesus says, God is seeking spirit and truth. What does spirit and truth mean? There's a lot of fun ways you could do that. And I have heard ways of people saying that the spirit is, you know, how you feel in your heart, and truth is the word. I've also heard how you can say that the spirit is actually the word, which is connected to God, and truth is you have to be sincere in your heart. So let's just be honest here. We can swap these words back and forth and end up saying the same thing. God is calling for some sort of connection here that is true and has spirit because that's what he is. Jesus is saying it's moving from places to persons. And like this whole story, it's all about connecting with people. Jesus is removing these barriers. God is looking for truth seekers, for spirit seekers. And that's exactly what Jesus was doing in chapter 4 here. And it's just fun to me that the story is a microcosm of that little idea that Jesus is teaching us here. So Jesus' conversation with the woman is God actively seeking this kind of person. And so what is, you know, we have to start asking ourselves this sort of a thing. What is our worship focus? Is it place or spirit? And there's a lot of important arguments for place. And there's a lot of important arguments for spirit. I don't think that I can just go hide in a, you know, in the woods by myself and do everything I need to do. But I also don't think that I can command thou shalt church building, because I haven't seen that in the scriptures either. And so Jesus is giving us a lot to work with and to think about here. So she says, Messiah? And he says, yeah. And she puts it all together. I think that's really neat. Because again, she could have been hung up on the physical place. No, I want to talk about the place. She's not hung up on the physical. She immediately keeps going with the spiritual. This lady is pretty neat. And like the rest of us, she has sin. But she's a really neat lady. So she is seeking, and she gets a good answer from Jesus. So in verse 27, just then his disciples came back. And they marveled because he was talking with a woman, but no one said, what do you seek, or why are you talking with her? So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ? And they went out of the town and were coming to him. Those are two different reactions that we can have to all of these sorts of connections and events, right? Did the disciples like the connection? No. I'm not going to say they were evil sinners, but they came up to it going, what's this about? Which implies this isn't right, or this is not what I would do, you know? What does she do with that connection? She runs out, and she's throwing fish hooks everywhere she gets. She becomes the fisher of men, right? She's pulling everyone into Jesus. These are two separate reactions. Now, it's nearly not fair for the disciples. She was just wowed and was, you know, rocked down to her boots, and so she's going to rush out the way that some of the apostles have in the past, I would imagine. But they come up and go, what's this about? And she goes out and says, you need to hear what this is about. And I think that those two differences are neat. And then in verse 31, meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, Rabbi, eat. But he said, he's still talking like he's talking to the lady, right? I have food to eat that you do not know about. And so the disciples said to him, has anyone brought him something to eat? You know, he's like, no, guys, I'm halfway through this chapter. You need to go back to the chapter and catch up with me, right? My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest? Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so that the sower and the reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you out to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor. God's harvest, right? This that's sown in peace by those who make peace. And Jesus is saying, you know, like, I don't just have a job. I have this vocation, this calling, this work of God. And some people have just a job, you know, but then they also live that vocation too, right? Now, there are some jobs that are so big that it kind of becomes, you know, life-encompassing. That's just kind of a reality. But if you, I've worked factories, if you work in a factory so that you can have a good weekend and be with your family in the evenings and in your weekend and help out at the church or try to reach, it's okay to have just a job because there is this life that's out there. And I think that Jesus is saying, this is my life, this is my work, this is my food to go to work. And, you know, they're scratching their heads like they would do. And he says, I almost get the impression he's frustrated with them. One of those mild frustrations. And when he says, lift your eyes and see that the harvest is ripe. I think this is one of the moments when he's speaking initially literally. He says, look, lift your eyes and see. Someone has already gone out and is already reaping that in. The lady went out and drew the whole town out to him. And so the wheat was heading toward them that they would harvest. I think that that's what he's doing here. It doesn't have to be, but it seems so neat. And so what we have here is the disciples being like the rest of us, nervous. What are we doing? What is he doing? How would I talk to this lady? Good, she left. Oh, great, now they're all coming. You know, I just have that image of what it might have been like to be them. But the reality is Jesus, because he's God, but Jesus had feelings too. And we know the lady had feelings as well because she's a human being. And connections with random people, and let's face it, I just talked about the people that I kind of, we've pretended to know each other. Connections with people we don't know at all and connections we have with people that we do know, they are scary. Not always, but they can be scary because it always involves vulnerability. The more I find out about you, the more I find out about you. And now you're in trouble because now I found out about you. And if I'm a jerk, then you're in trouble, right? That's not everyone, few people are going to be that way, but connection demands vulnerability. Jesus made himself vulnerable talking to her. He did. He made himself vulnerable talking to everybody. Even the Son of God did. Now, I think he had some strength more than maybe than I have. But the lady reciprocated. And she, it, already a Samaritan and a woman in a vulnerable state, allowed that and became more vulnerable by answering and speaking and possibly answering sarcastically and engaging with Jesus and learning. And how vulnerable do you think she was running into town and getting everybody to come out? Who cares about vulnerability? This is the Messiah. I think that this is a neat moment. Nicodemus, in the last chapter, made himself vulnerable. He tried to protect himself as much as he could. I'll do it at night. I'll do it in these special ways. And I'm not going to knock him for that because I'm scared of things too. But Peter, every apostle, everyone who's all of us, when we make these connections, you know, me coming here, there's this vulnerability and trying to connect. Sometimes it's with somebody new because we want to introduce them to the gospel. Sometimes it's with Jesus and the apostles, and they're not new, but he's trying to get them to connect better and to understand more. I see this chapter isn't just an evangelism chapter. It's a how do we all connect with God, with Jesus, with each other, you know, with some of the phrases from Jesus that are interesting that we need to meditate on. There's a lot of connection going on here. In verse 42, they said to the woman, after he's been there a while, it's no longer because of what you have said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world. They made their own connections. And that's a big deal here. The town didn't become Christian. Everyone in town became a Christian, is the image there. It's not, I'm a Christian because of my mom and dad. I have to be a Christian because I have made, you know, I know that this is the Savior of the world. I think that that's a really important verse to communicate to children and to family members and to friends as we are trying to make these connections. Maybe that speaks to a lot of when people are talking about you need to have a personal relationship with God. I don't use that phrase very often. I think it's kind of overdone some, but that's exactly what this is. Each individual needs to make that connection with God, not just assume that some institution can do it for me. And our work is in front of us, right? That's how this sermon, how this lesson and story ends for me, is like, here I am. I'm this great preacher. All right, you heard how lame that is. I'm this great preacher. I get to stand behind the lectern, which means I'm important. But no, I have so much work in trying to talk to people in situations that feel intimidating or situations, how do I get this going in the right direction towards a spiritual conversation? How do I turn off my, I want to argue about Jew and Samaritan differences? How do I turn off that switch? Like, there's all these things that get in the way that Jesus was able to work past or work around, leaving the Pharisees to bicker about their stuff and finding some lady in the town and winning a town because of that. And there's just a lot of ideas in the story that get me excited, try to get me encouraged to do that and to do that more. I want to close by looking at Isaiah 12. I like to close by looking at a psalm, usually, and Isaiah 12 counts. Isaiah 12 is the end of Isaiah 11, right? It doesn't just come after Isaiah 11. Isaiah 11 happens, and I believe Isaiah 12 is the conclusion or is the result of that. It's such a great little bit of a psalm here. Isaiah chapter 12, you will say in that day, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, for though you were angry with me, your anger turned away, that you might comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation, and you will say in that day, give thanks to the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the peoples, proclaim that his name is exalted. Sing praises to the Lord, for he has done gloriously. Let this be made known in all the earth. Shout and sing for joy, O inhabitants of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. And it just seems like it walks through that little story. I love it. I want to take the time to mention this because I think this is important. One of the places where English fails that Southern American wins is that it has the word y'all. In verse 1, it's you will say in that day, and then beginning in verse 6, with joy, y'all will draw water. It turns into a plural, which in English we don't have unless you let y'all be a word. And I think that that's a really neat movement. This is personal, and then we go out, and we sing praises to the Lord, for he has done gloriously. Let this be made known in all the earth. So I think that that's a neat connection to John chapter 4. That's what I have for my lesson. I appreciate this chance and this opportunity. If you have questions about the sermon, awesome. If you have questions about me or if you want to talk to my family or if you want to try to set something up, I'm really happy to do that.